Scalpins Avenue. Small doses.
Self-help from the hip.
Small doses.
We're talking that shit.
Small doses.
And keeping it real.
Small doses.
With me and Nana Seals.
It's so funky.
Welcome to another episode of Small Doses. How y'all doing? I know that the quality of this picture is a lot lower than typical, and that's because there's no light in this hotel room because it's pouring rain outside. You can't stop the rain. This episode of Small Doses is a revisit of a classic episode with hedge fund founder Arlen Hamilton called Side Effects of Being Underestimated. And you know what? I feel like so often when we talk about underestimation, we're talking about like other people underestimating us, but we oftentimes don't acknowledge that like we underestimate ourselves. I mean, that's the imposter syndrome of things as well. But like, I know I do that all the time and I constantly have to remind myself like, no, bitch, you got this. Like there'll be times where I'll say to myself like, damn, like if I just had this particular person, then I could make this happen. It's like, no, you can still make it happen. Or sometimes it'll be like, no, like you actually have that in your mind. Or it's something that it's like, okay, maybe it's a particular person with a particular expertise. And it's like, just meditate on that and you can find that person and take the next steps. But oftentimes it's not even that I need an extra person. It's just that in my mind, I'm like, oh, I can't do it. But it's like, but you can, you can. You know, this weekend I was at the Kennedy Center. And we have been planning on these three shows at the Kennedy Center for years now because COVID had stumped everything. And we did Smart, Funny, and Black Live. We did Small Doses Podcast Live. Shout out to everybody who came out to the live taping. And I did my stand-up. So we did an evening with Amanda Seals. The first show, Smart, Funny, and Black Live and stand-up were in the concert hall of the comedy at the Kennedy Center. 2,500 seats. Okay? 2,500 seats. And I got to tell you, they were sold out. Like we ended up selling out, like we ended up selling out these tickets. And I genuinely was so proud of myself because it just seemed like such a behemoth task to do. Now we have Seattle coming up and we have Portland and we have all these future dates, but it just felt like this right here was something that I just was like, oh my gosh, I don't know how we're going to accomplish it. And the fact that we did it was not only an accomplishment, but also showed me like you really be underestimating yourself. Like you really do have folks that rock with what you do. And oftentimes the reason why you underestimate yourself is because you're in a bubble or because you're listening to the wrong people. But this weekend really reminded me like, Amanda, the work that you have been putting in and that you consistently put in, like it is begetting rewards and it will continue to beget rewards. And you need to actually acknowledge yourself for that. I was talking to my man, and he was like, you know, I think oftentimes you don't realize that you're an ecosystem. You know, you're your own ecosystem. Like you are creating shit from nothing. You're creating shit from other shit that you've created before. Like you don't require an ecosystem to plug into in order for you to create. And so often that's what other folks do. And he was like, I think a lot of times you'll be looking at like, oh, I need this person or I need that person in order to, you know, advance or to, you know, just level up something that you're looking to do. And he was like, but those people need people like you to plug into because without that, they don't have anything to level up or to advance. And so, you know, when we think about the idea of being underestimated, when we think about the idea of how we are moving in the world and what we consider to validate us, so often it is ourselves that are doing the underestimating. And we have to take a better look at what we are considering as the value points to how we are constructing our worth and our expectations and our potential. I'm having to step into a space consciously that I don't think I really ever consciously stepped into, which is that I don't want a manager. I need a COO. And that's something that I never truly grasped. Like I always thought like, oh, I need a manager so they can manage and, you know, be the go-between. And I realized that in the version of manager that this industry calls for, it doesn't meet the needs that I have because I'm somebody that is always thinking of things on a macro level, but that is always involved in the thinking of those things. And a manager, and oftentimes these managers, they really are the ones who do that. And it's that whole idea is like, they're going to take your idea and expand it while you go over here and create. But I'm like, nah, I want to go over here and create. And then I want to go over there with you and help this idea expand. And then they feel like you're encroaching on their territory, or you feel like, you know, they feel like you're micromanaging them, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, I ain't got time for you to be feeling like that. But for me, I really truly think that I've been underestimating myself in my capability to truly like own the fact that I do manage myself in a legitimate way. And even if it's not necessarily the thing I want to be doing all the time, like it is a thing that has like actual value because of my knowledge of my own company. And that is something that if someone's going to step into, they need to really truly understand. And I recently had someone coming into my company who I think it had the best of intentions, but didn't truly understand that for you to actually manage this in the proper way, you can't just jump in. You have to really like take almost a spiritual approach to this space. Then there's the idea of underestimating yourself about like, okay, what do I deserve? And also like, what do I need? And I know that this COO position, I think I was underestimating myself on like, do I have enough business to even warrant that? And there's this like TikTok sound where the chick is like, I don't like when people say like, you know, I see you with your little business. No, ain't nothing little over here. It's big business, big. And I know I'm paraphrasing, but like, that's what I had to tell myself. Like, no, like I'm not trying to create like some big multimillion dollar corporation, conglomerate, et cetera, et cetera. Y'all know I don't even fuck capitalism like that. But I want to create, I want a space where I can continue to create and have options and, you know, be able to support myself and my family and my mom, et cetera. And I've been building and building to do towards that. And you have hiccups and you have parts that don't actually like turn out the way you think they are, or people, parties that turn out that don't actually turn out the way that you thought they would. And, you know, you got to keep pivoting. You got to keep pivoting. But I definitely feel like I had underestimated the value of my own company and the value of my own vision in it deserving somebody like a COO. And that's some shit. I had to sit with that. Like, why you keep trying to lull your business, Amanda? Like, why do you keep trying to do that? And I don't know, why do we do that? Is it because we want to remain humble? Possibly. Is it because we think there's a certain level of modesty that we need to retain? Possibly. Is it also just this constant like outside thing that people are trying to do to humble you? And so you're like, well, let me humble myself first before they humble me. But then you realize that like they're trying to humble you because they are jealous or because they are threatened or because they're insecure. It's not really that they're trying to humble you. They're trying to just make you shrink to make them feel bigger. Because sometimes it's like, why you need to be humbled? If you're just living in your truth and you're moving and you're growing and you are being responsible about how you do that and you are being generous about how you do that. Where's the humble part need to be put in? And why does someone outside need to humble you? I feel like I definitely, you know, do the Eminem 8 Mile thing sometimes where it's like, I'm going to do the thing first before you can do it to me. Aha, gotcha. And then you're just like, yeah, but like they weren't even trying to do that. So like that was really just you living in your trauma. Ooh, we are living, hey, in now. Ooh, in our trauma, trauma, trauma. RTRAUMA. Ba-ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba. So I had to really like catch myself on that because that was not actually the thing. And what's the other reasons that we like put the lil in front of our things? I think sometimes we put the lil in front of it also because we fear dealing with the magnitude of if it isn't lil, if it is big, you know, it's like, damn, then I got to step up. I got to level up. That's responsibilities. Am I ready for that? Am I willing to do that? Do I have what it takes? Scary stuff. Scary stuff. But what I love about this episode is that Arlen Hamilton shows us all that at the end of the day, it's really about finding your vision and pursuing your vision and staying true to that and sticking with that and letting that be the bottom line, letting that be the thesis that you keep coming back to when you have those questions of being underestimated that come to you in your mind, and when people outside also are underestimating you. It's like, you can underestimate me all you want, but I know what I am doing, and I know what I want to do. Even if I'm figuring out how I'm going to do it, I know what I want to do, and I'm sticking on that path. And you may not know or trust or believe that I can accomplish it, but that's irrelevant. Because I don't need you anyway. Well, then why'd you ask me? Because I thought you could be helpful. But clearly, you don't see the vision. So it doesn't matter. Keep it moving. What I love about this story is that Arlen Hamilton talks to us about how she went from being homeless and living in the San Francisco airport to eventually achieving her vision. And then her vision is about helping others achieve their vision. And she just needed one person to believe in her to get on her feet. And that's another thing I want to remind y'all. So often we underestimate the power of quality over quantity. You don't need everybody to believe in you. You don't. You just need the right ones. You just need the right ones. And sometimes it's just you need the right one. Yeah. And that can be frustrated. And that can be just a definite, like, buzzkill. But truth be told, you stay the course as long as you can. One of the gems that I got out of this episode was Arlen telling me after this episode about, you know, when it comes to investing, hold out as long as you can. You know, you may have an idea that you're like, I don't want to put my own money into it. So you don't need to hold out, because you're going to just from Jump Street, you know how you're going to build that. But she was like, if it's something that you've put your money into already, and you're already on it, and you've been pushing it, hold out as long as you can. Because once you bring in an investor, now you're talking to them, you have to answer with them. She's like, it's not to say that they have, like, you know, the full run of the country company, and you got to answer to them, but now you got to have conversations with them. And you may not want to do that. And you may not have to do that if you are staying the course. So I welcome you all in this summer replay to check out Arlen Hamilton's advice, her knowledge, her wisdom on what it means for side effects of being underestimated. Remember to like, subscribe, and all that good shit. Welcome to another episode of Small Doses, where today we are joined with a different kind of guest. Now, see, typically I'd be having real artsy-fartsy people on here, or woo-woo, you know, people who are like, you know, the astrology and the stars and the skies. And I really want to make sure that we are having a well-rounded set of conversations here at Small Doses. You know, full disclosure to our guests, the first 3 years of doing this podcast was a lot of just me talking, okay? It was a lot of just me on here just talking and pontificating. And I feel like it's time that we open up the space for other voices that know about things that I don't really know about. I ain't a dummy, but I feel like the expertise that we are going to be shared with today is, it makes us very lucky folks. We have Ms. Arlen Hamilton, author of It's About Damn Time, joining us. Arlen because I don't even want to get this wrong. How do you categorize yourself? Because I feel like I read a couple different things, and I know that people like will call me an actress, and I'm like, I act, but I'm a comedian. So like, how do you categorize?
I like that. Yourself? I like that. Well, so I'm an investor.
Okay.
But you can call me a venture capitalist.
Okay.
All right. I love that you asked that.
So what is some of these questions are going to seem very basic, Arlen, because this interview is very much for me also just like getting some learning, because I will say this, we have a lot of creatives that listen to this podcast, and for creatives, business is definitely kind of this, like, a lot of times this like wonky thing that you have to figure out in order to make money to continue to be a creative.
That's right.
And
that's right.
I know for me, I usually create first and then have to figure out the business, which is not necessarily like the best order of things. But it is something that,
is just what it is if you're trying to live off of your creativity, right? And I think as a woman, particularly my independence in that space and my knowledge base in that space has become more and more just the necessity for that becomes more and more apparent because every time that I try to just hire somebody to handle it, they fuck me over. To my chagrin, I've had to just like be like, you know what, Amanda, like you can't run from it anymore. And so I feel like a lot of our listeners are probably in that similar space also because COVID and, you know, you have to, the financial scenario of what's going on in our nation has really forced a lot of us to have to become very intimate with our finances. So can we just start off with what is a venture capitalist?
We absolutely can. And I will say that 10 years ago, I didn't know what a venture capitalist was either. There's no real reason for people to know what one is. So don't feel bad if you don't know what it
okay.
is. It's a tool that I'm using to break in to get more capital and resources to underrepresented people.
Gotcha.
That they deserve. That, you know, this isn't a nonprofit. And so that's why I know so much about it today. Because I didn't have any money. I was broke. I was broke till I was 35. I had no money, didn't make more than $20,000 in any given year up until 35. And had been on food stamps for some of it, homeless for some of it. And when you're trying to break into something like venture capital, which I will explain, and you don't have any money of your own, you can't really right. come to the table unless you figure out a way to bring money to you and to attract money. So that's what I did.
Now, can I just interject real quick? Did you grow up in a family that lacked money, or was there a turn of events in your life that caused this to happen?
No, I grew up in a family that lacked money. Very incredible mother who is still with us and listening to this, I know, and she's gonna text me about my grammar, so I'm prepared for that. Just a highly capable woman.
Hey, mom.
Who found herself in situations where she just didn't have enough money most of the time. And my brother and I, you know, most of us, we grew up this way. I worked since I was 15.
Yep.
Put that money to work at the, you know, for rent and things like that. And I also had some really wonderful times. You know, we had a lot of laughter in this family, a lot of joy.
Oh, don't feel like you need to qualify, whether or not. I'm just curious because I think sometimes people conflate the difference between poor and broke, right? And
no, I know that because I grew up around white people. Like, I know they conflate the. I'm going to have to dip into my savings. Oh. Oh, so you're not broke then. You're not.
So you're broke. You're not
you're
poor.
You're not poor then.
You just having a moment.
Okay. So no, I grew up. So my mom had a job, you know, so we weren't under poverty level there. But once I became, you know, we had issues. And so, you know, when became an adult, it just never could get head above water. And I kind of know now why after spending so much time with both creatives. So I worked in the music production on the road. So it's tour managing and tour coordinating kind of character and working with entrepreneurs today. I just, you know, it's like you said with creatives, there's a different mindset. So I was always trying to prioritize community and yes. reaching people and impact. Yes. Yes. And where was the money, right? so there was that. So I didn't have any certain things that just happened. It was like I've never had a point before recently where I had like any kind of savings or any kind of, this is what you're supposed to do with this, that, and the other. So it was always working to kind of pay the bills.
The work.
And yeah, and then a lot of times I'm also I will say that I'm kind, you know, a lot of people say they're not employable. I feel that way. I'll tell you a quick story. Just kind of put it to this, you know, a little sideways here. I worked at a kind of a porn place. Now it wasn't, they weren't producing.
How was it kind of a porn place? You know, they just do dick sucking. They don't actually be fucking. They're just kind.
Sorry, Mom. Okay. No. No, okay. So I was broke, poor. And I was in my, late 20s, early mid-20s. And I was living with a friend, like on their floor. And I needed a job. And so I was in Chatsworth, California, which is the porn capital of the world. I found out.
Is it?
It is. Okay. It is. And so... this was a place, nondescript building where they didn't produce porn, but they like sold it. They're distributors. So okay. You had to look at all this porn and give it like data entry, basically. Pardon. So you had to like type in, well, this is this type of thing. I'm not going to go into detail because, as I mentioned earlier, my mother is listening. But you had, you know, this is, it was very clinical. It was very, oh, okay, can somebody throw me this one, you know,
ass. Big booty girls. Can somebody throw me big booty Brazilians? Yes. Five. Thanks.
Yes. No, let me get started on like how they categorize Black people versus non. It's a whole another story.
Anywho. BBC and all that. Yeah.
Anywho, I'm there. And I'm working, and there's this gentleman who's like five years.
Wait, side note, let me find out. There's a whole other podcast we could do with Arlen. One.
So okay. I'm good at it, right? So they tell me what to do, and I'm like, okay, this is what you do. You type, and you have to, it's analytical, and I'm good at that. So okay. I finish first few days of it early. And it's an hourly paid thing. And so there's just, you have a certain number you're doing, you have to go. So I'm like, it takes me like 30 minutes to walk home. I'm going to walk home. I'm going to leave early because I'm finished, right? I'm not going to just have them paying me. So I left. Oh. So like the third or fourth day, this young gentleman who's younger than me brings me into his office. He's my boss, quote unquote, whatever. And he brings me to his office and he's like, well, I heard you went home early. And he has his feet on the desk.
Of course.
Young guy. And I'm like, yeah. And I explained to him, I got really good at it. I know what I'm doing. And I didn't want to charge you guys too much because it's hourly. And I needed to walk home. So I was on my way. And he tried to sort of chastise me. And I just started laughing at him. And I was like, no, I don't care enough. And he, now mind you, like that was some Popeye money. You know, I needed that money. But I'm always just like, and he said, well, I need you to, you can't do that again. You can't leave early again. And I was like, that's just ridiculous. So then I started laughing and I said, you know, you need someone who works for you, who's not going to laugh in your face. This is not fair to you. I'm going to just go. And he's like, no, come back. And I said, I'm just going to go. We're good. And I just left and I just walked out. And I'm like, I am so unemployable. I can't even sit still at this job without telling him what he's supposed to do as a manager. And so partially led to why I was broke because I can't do small talk and I can't do like fake stuff. I just can't.
You
I just
met
can't
me sit before? Still.
So I can't explain it to the master. Like, but I just
and you
do
get
it.
Called many things for that, right? So you get called difficult, you get called unemployable, etc. When really it's more so that you're just kind of like your own ecosystem. And it's very and as a woman, I do feel like you are constantly being told that like that's not okay. You can't be your own ecosystem. If you can't be the fifth person on the fifth finger on the hand, if you can't, then you're not a team player, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, no, I'm a team player. I'm just a team captain.
Exactly. And that's what I understood that now in this position that I'm in, all the things that my whole life had been signaled to me as wrong, being too loud, too outspoken, having all these ideas all at once, working on things that, you know, you can't focus, all those things, they work for me now. And people call upon me and pay me for most of these things, you know?
And pay you to teach them how to be those things.
100%. And are asked, you know, how are you like that? And it's so funny because that's why I say be authentic. And I try to get that message out in my book. It's like, you know, you can, I got here. I made it here. If I can get here being me, woo, you know.
Baby.
Yeah.
I mean, so y'all should know, I have never met Arlen before. This is the first time I'm meeting Arlen. I have chills because that is really like the bottom line messaging of this podcast is figuring out how, like the myriad of ways to be yourself in a world that constantly tries to tell you like who you are is not enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's interesting to hear that specifically as it relates to the financial sector, because I think for what it's worth, we look at that as like a very rigid, a very like specific, a very white male waspy kind of, you know, it's typically either like white male waspy or like Jewish male, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's like the two kind of trajectories.
Wall Street for sure. Like New York for sure. Yeah.
Yes.
And then Silicon Valley and West Coast, where a lot of tech and venture capital comes from, it is a very much so male and white. In fact, 90% of all venture funding goes to white men, and 90% plus of the check writers are white men. And we're doing things as a group to change that in Silicon Valley and beyond. But that's where I walked into the scene.
So how did you walk in? Because I got to be, if I'm honest.
Please do.
If I'm honest. I feel like I hold myself back because those spaces just feel like they're going to be so frustrating and annoying. And then if I'm really being honest with myself, I feel like I'm going to be out intellectualized. And so of those areas. And so mm-hmm. I think there's like a large part of me that doesn't explore like what it would mean to work with those types of people, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I'm just going to end up sad.
I think you're describing imposter syndrome, which a lot of people have.
Oh, yes. We've done an episode about that. I do have that.
And I there's so many things that come to mind when you say that. One thing is, like, I'm a nice person. I don't want people to think that I'm not a nice person.
Nobody thinks you're not a nice person.
Yeah, I don't try to, like, come back. But I do not hold these guys in high regard when it comes to their intellect or their positioning and all that. I don't think that I'm going to get outgunned intellectually with them.
I just don't know their shit.
Yeah, so I don't know it either. And I didn't know it either. What I do know, though, is that I can out-research. Okay, you looking up somebody did you wrong. I don't know your orientation. I haven't, you know, searched your orientation, but your ex-boyfriend, ex-girlfriend, whomever does you wrong.
I am a cisgendered heterosexual woman.
Right. Ex-boyfriend does you wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Are Black women not the most detective having being people, you know? I mean, you can hack into, like, we should be running the government's, like...
The NSA.
Yeah, like we are some hacking.
I mean, I consider myself a certified Instagram forensic specialist.
Yes, thank you. So what I'm saying is, like, if I don't know something, I know how to figure it out. I'm sure. Going to figure it out.
Sure.
And so going into it like that, I was, that's part of it. Another part of it is I have a very high risk tolerance. I just do. It's not that I'm a risk taker. It's not that I go like, oh, I got to have adrenaline all the time. But I have a high risk tolerance because when you've been broke and poor your whole life, there's not much people can take from you that you can lose, you know, that you have to lose. So it's like, okay, I know that.
I think what you're describing is courage. I was describing imposter syndrome. I think what you're describing is bravery and
perhaps. Yeah, I'm not afraid of looking stupid and being wrong.
That is... are y'all listening? Are y'all listening? Because that is what really... that's what stops so many of us. My mom is always like, I'm just amazed at like the shit you try. And I'm like, yeah, because at the end of the day, like if it don't work, it's not because I'm dumb. It's just because it didn't...
It didn't work. Yeah.
So what made you say it's time to make that change? Like you left the ass and titties building.
That was, yeah, I left that, walked right into Silicon Valley. I was in Silicon Valley and I walked right into it. No, some years had passed. I got myself into touring with musicians because that had been a lifelong goal of mine, dream of mine. I saw Janet Jackson perform in the first row when I was 13 years old. And from that moment, I wanted
to. What tour?
The Janet period tour.
All right.
Yes.
All right.
1994. Yes. I was 13. I didn't know half of the stuff she was talking about, but I knew I liked it. I knew it was.
Right. It was, Rob came on and you were like, I don't know what this is, but the moves.
But I just loved the live aspect of it so much. It was like, I just was energized by it. I couldn't dance, couldn't sing, but I was like, I want to be on the road with this circus. I like this circus feel to it.
Yes.
And then to look back at the audience and just see all races get dancing, singing together, genders, orientations, singing the same lyrics that this Black woman had told them to sing. You know what I mean? Like, it was so powerful to me and empowering. And I said, I just want to be around whatever this feeling is. And so I made it my mission to become something on the road. I tracked down her tour manager when I was 15 years old. And I met with him and interviewed him.
Hilarious.
I went there, and then, you know, had a lot happen in between. And then I got myself to working on tours that weren't indie artists, how I started. And then I was 30, 31, about a decade ago. And I looked in and I saw people like Ellen and Ashton Kutcher and Troy Carter, who used to manage Lady Gaga, is a black man who did that. They were all making investments in Silicon Valley. And I was like, why are these people who are rich and famous and having a, you know, who have an interesting life, why do they care about this place? I was just so curious about it. So I started following the money. And the more I learned about it, the more I realized, oh, I'm an entrepreneur. It was like coming out twice, like for the second time. It was like, oh, I'm an entrepreneur. Oh, I'm a startup founder. Oh, okay. I didn't realize that there's a name for it. And all these things that I was trying, they're called moonshot ideas, quote unquote. And there's a, and in Silicon Valley, if you have a moonshot idea and you attempt it and then it fails, you are a hero. I was like, sign me up.
Wait, okay, so wait, what is a moonshot idea?
It just means the same thing we were describing before, is where you don't you have a high risk tolerance. You dream of things that are bigger than what most people around you dream of.
Oh, so like everything, okay.
These big ideas, where before I was, you know, it was, the signal was, oh, you don't have health insurance, you need to get a job, you need to get, you need to do this and that and not be weird. This was signaling to me, oh, you are kind of one of these people.
Yeah.
And so I was interested in that. So I started doing more research, which I do all the time. And then I learned, oh, but if I want to raise money or have a fighting chance in Silicon Valley, I have to share the 10% that everyone who's not a white man gets, because 90% of venture funding goes to white men. And
venture funding, for folks who don't know, is the pursuit of capital to start...
Yeah, it's the capital that goes into mostly earlier stage companies. So it's post idea. An idea, dime a dozen. They all exist. We all have ideas. But if you've put that to, I'm going to try to get somebody who's technically inclined, they're going to put together an app for me, or we're going to get together and do some no code stuff that's just, you know, on a website. And then we have this idea and we're going to do, where we want to have 100,000 customers one day, but we're going to start with 5 to prove that it works. All of that is traction. All of that is like getting started. Mm-hmm. And once you realize the idea actually works, people are paying for this. So just think of Twitter. Early days of Twitter were just people, you know, a few people texting each other. It was spelled differently. It looked weird. It wasn't what it is today, but they had this inkling of people like it and it's taking off. They got money infused at that inflection point.
Do they go out and get it? So for instance, like I started an app last year called SFB Society. Mm-hmm. And SFB Society is a membership community app for Black folks and allies. And the beauty of it is that that membership protects them from trolls and Karens and hoteps. And it's really blossomed into... it's blossomed into this... you know, internal community of intellectuals, of professionals, and, you know, and also just of people who are just like, yo, like, I want to be able to have, like, laughs as well as, like, real conversations and not have to, you know, we always say it's social media for people who want conversation without confrontation, right?
Yes, yes.
So we built this. And I invested my money into it. And I know there's a lot of us on here who are like me, where it's like, I never get past the part where I invest my own money. I never, there's the next part I feel like people are so good at, like at getting other people to come and invest money. And well, I always feel like I'm a peddler if I do that.
I'm going to say there's a couple ways here. Like, yes, to answer your question, this would be an inflection point for you or something you've built is working. And if you want it to become 10x the size it is, or if you think there's a way to monetize it in a certain way, then yes, you could go out and say, now I want to do a round of funding to prove that out. The other thing that I'll say though, is even though I am an investor who looks for those types of companies, I'm also the same person who came in 10 years ago Mm-hmm. And I really see it as it is. Mm-hmm. And once you take outside funding, it's like being an employee again.
My mom always says, you take their money, you take their shit.
Yes, your mother is right. Absolutely right.
So you would, is it safe to say that if you can sustain on your own dime, do it as long as you can?
I would say 100% yes. Yes. Okay. I would say that, okay, so I've started a couple of side hustles because I'm an entrepreneur and I can't help myself, mm-hmm. Even though I have this fund. And I have not taken on venture funding, whereas I can today, if I wanted to, I could put a tweet out most likely and pull together a few million dollars for a company.
Slide flex! There was a flex! Did you hear? No,
there was a flex.
I mean, I could put a tweet out and get a couple mails. No problem. M's. I mean, y'all are out here talking about you a boss bitch because you got a Birkin, but I could really put out a tweet and get a couple M's. So I need everybody to just relax.
Okay.
That was the flex of the year for me. She said that with no irony, y'all. She said that just in casual combo. Carry on.
Let me compose myself. Hold on.
That was such a flex.
Oh my God. Okay. Woo. So, as I was saying, it's true. I'm saying because of all this, the last decade
yeah,
of work.
Yeah, you put in the work.
I could do. I'm gonna turn the video off for you.
Well, here's a question for you though. So when you say that because of the last decade you could do that, do you feel like it's because of the connections you've made? Like, what?
Yeah, yes, what I'm saying. So what I could do that, but I've chosen not to. Mm-hmm. That's how much I believe that you should hold on to as much of your own ownership as you can.
Right.
As a person who, for a living, I make investments, and my job is to say to founders, let me take some of your company. Mm-hmm. I'm saying when I do my own company, I try to hold on to as much equity as I can, because mm-hmm. You can then do what you want with that. I could donate some of it if I wanted to. Yeah. It's not all about just me having it. I could give it to family. It's about that power and leverage that you have when you own it. And when other people put their money in, they're not just putting their money in out of the goodness of their heart. They're going to have a say or want a say in what you do. So if you have something, there's so many people who come to Backstage, my fund, and to me personally, who are very early in their process. And they're like, if you just give me $100,000, I'll give you 20% of my company. Well, okay, the math is good for me. But what about the next 7 years? You're going to have to do this over and over again. You're going to have, 4% of your company at the end when you actually do sell it? Why would you rather do that than to really think about, let's do this for a couple of years on your own and build up the valuation of it, the value of it, so mm-hmm. much so that when you take the same $100,000 next time, it's for a fraction of that, if you're going to do it at all.
And when you talk about building up the valuation of your company, that is what?
That's in building all the traction. So there's a difference between what you're talking about. So you have, we'll use your company as an example. Okay. It sounds to me like you have the infrastructure in place. The website itself and the platform itself has been built. That's a big deal.
Yes.
So that is something. It's built. Mm-hmm. Now, depending on how it's built, if it's built on all third party, meaning you went to a no-code place and you have this and you're pulling this and that, that's one thing. If you have technical people who have built it from scratch, that is another thing, because that's like a valuable thing. It's like having real estate, you know, versus leasing out a place,
mm-hmm.
right? That's one thing. Then the people, how many people you have in the room, in the building, how many people are partying in the building?
Right.
What did they pay to get into the front door? All those things. You know, what's the value? Do they keep coming back, or do they come in once and like, I'm not going to come back every month? Do they come back every week? Is it 30% active compared
to how
many
signups? We've been told that we have, so we are, Mighty Networks is who built our app.
Yep.
And we've been told that our engagement is like beyond the regular scale.
Because
we have people that thrive in there, mm-hmm. right? So like we have people who've done, you know, something. I mean, I think there was like two people who've done like 20,000 engagements, like things like that. So, you know, so that's something that's been a learning curve for me too, is like what brings value. Like I just thought it was based on registrants, you know, and then we learned like, no, like every time someone likes a post and all that stuff, like the interaction, I mean, being in tech is a new world for me. But I think, you know, I will absolutely tell you that this pandemic forced me to go into tech because I'm a live performer. So like the touring world that you come from, like I have always said, I don't need Hollywood. I always had the road. And then the road was like, gotcha, bitch.
Yeah.
No, you don't. Sit your ass down. And it was like, oh man. And then like Smart, Funny, and Black, which is our live show that we tour, we had to figure out how to do a virtual version of that show, you know? And so, and people have tried to buy it from me and I'm like, no.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the case. That's the case with the company itself. Because another thing you have to know is that when, especially venture capitalists, but also angel investors, when they put their money in today, they're doing it because they not only think that you're going to keep raising money, which is a whole kind of hamster wheel, but they think that you're going to one day sell the company or go public. So if you don't have that in mind, then venture capital is not necessarily for you. And you can have a great company. They call it a lifestyle business, but whatever. It just means you're making money for yourself and it's working and you don't have to answer to most people, you know? So. Right. There's no right or wrong way to do it. It's just knowing the difference.
Yeah.
It's important.
I mean, like Master P had once said that when the record company came and offered him $1 million, he knew he was worth at least four.
That's it. He's such a great example of what I'm talking about. He's such a great example.
And I find that, you know, I think, you know, when you talked about that, just like you have a high risk level. I have a homeboy who is hilarious. And one day he was like, you know, I hear a lot of niggas talking about this thing lately and it makes me feel like I need to get up on it. And I was like, what? And he was like, you know, it's just this audacity. Mm. I need to get me some audacity.
Yes.
And I was like, what you mean? And he was like, because I just feel like a lot of folks I know, they just be having the audacity to try some shit, to throw some shit out there, to take a step. And he was like, you know, I just feel like maybe I need to get more audacity so I can, you know, be, it's like if you make a drastic move, you can get a drastic result type shit.
That's right. I'm going to add that to my resume. So I think that's what I
didn't You're have audacious. Any
money. Yeah, I didn't have any money, but I had some of that for sure.
So where did the turn come for you? You were doing all this research and you were just like, you know, I know that this is what I found my home in. And I can relate to that completely because that's how it was for me in comedy. And you said it was around 31, 32, and that's at the end of your Saturn returns. And in astrology, like that's when you hit that point where like you've gone through the whole, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know who I am. And you're like, oh, what's this shit over here?
Yeah.
And for me, that was comedy. Like all the things that you said that people like saw as flaws, you came into this space and it was your tribe and it was a place that made everything make sense. That was me for comedy. Everything people told me that was whack about me, I became a comic and they were like, oh my God, all of these things are an asset to you being successful in this space.
Yes.
So what, but again, it's one thing for me to be like, I want to do comedy and then go do open mics. It's another thing for you to be like, I feel like I should be a venture capitalist and then be venture capitalizing.
Well, so it took until I was almost 35 to actually get my first investment. So for 3.5 years after I figured this out, I virtually and then in person went, you know, knocked around and said, hey, rich person, would you like to invest in this fund that I have, this idea I have to invest in other underrepresented people who are people of color, who are women, LGBTQ. I identify as all three. I think in the very near future, tech is going to change. You know, the face of tech is going to change. We should get in now. And I knew in my heart that as soon as I said that, everybody would just open up their purses, their clutches, and they would be ready. Yeah. But for 3.5 years, people were like, either they were like, pat on the head, oh, I hope you do well, bless your heart. Or they were like, blatantly, no, that is not going to work. No one's going to give you money. I was laughed out of a room once, like physically laughed out of a boardroom. I went in very earnestly. I was living at the airport. They didn't know this, so they could never know this. But I was living at the airport, didn't know if I was going to eat every day. Found my way into this boardroom.
I got to stop you there.
Okay.
I was going to try and keep it moving, and I just... Because I need to know which airport, and I just need to know the schematics, because I went on a date with a guy who was living in a Winnebago, and I had questions. And he was like, why? He was like, you too good for me. And I was like, it's not that. I just can't comfortably fuck in this Winnebago. And I don't.
Well, good thing that, okay. Well, so this was the San Francisco. Well, Winnebago's made for living, isn't it? Isn't it made for?
But he didn't. I felt like he wasn't.
He didn't disclose.
It was that he just, I just was like, I need to hear a hygiene path in this. I feel better about an airport because I know there's facilities.
There are facilities.
Campus.
There's even a yoga room at the one that I was in.
I was going to say, which airport? Because if you were in the Bay,
yeah,
San Francisco airport ain't no slouch.
Yeah, I wasn't like, I made a very conscious decision that I would never, that I could not, I mean, if I had to, I would, but I was like, if I reached the point where I'm sleeping on the outside ground, I think my soul would die. And I'm just being real serious. So I was like, that was a promise I made to myself. So I said, okay, where am I going to live? I don't have any money. The people who care about me the most don't have any money. They're making their way across the country. But I still want to start a fund, and I can't get a job. So let's do this. So I said, well,
do you have a phone at this point?
I had a phone, you know, they make it easy. It's expensive to be poor, you know, but you can get your hands on things, right, and pay a lot more for it. So I had a phone. I had a laptop. I had a suitcase. I used rolled up jeans as a pillow. I was, during the day, I would be out, but if I was at the airport, I would go to the Virgin Airlines section because they always had music on. And then I would go down later, further to get away. And I would always just kind of tell myself so that it would kind of get out there, you know, in my emoting that I was someone who just missed their flight. You know, it's very poetic, but it was the way that I kept myself going. I just simply missed my flight today and keep going. But that I, you know, they do have facilities, and there's a lot of stuff I struggle with, like OCD and certain things. So it was not it was very mentally draining for me to be there.
Blood bodies.
Yeah. So it was all of that. But I did it to serve, because I said, where can I go that's indoors, where there's access to food if I can get the money for it, and that I feel safe. And to me, that was it.
I have to know, have you since flown Virgin?
Let me tell you something. The first, so after I got started working, and I also had these other income streams that I built, I said, the first time I get any kind of status on a flight, on an airline, it's going to be Virgin. So I was triple, dipple, flipple, gold status. And not only that, that and Delta, because, you know, black. Not only that, landed in San Francisco about once every 2 weeks for work, and most times would pass by where I slept. And every time I did, and I can still kind of see it, you know, the path that I take, I would get emotional. I would get, you know, I would know what was going
right
on.
Now. I'm emotional. I'm like, she better have a script in process for this.
Yeah, my book, It's About Damn Time, has been optioned, but also I'm buying the option back because I like equity.
That makes sense. Yes. Yeah. So you got somebody, and why do you think this particular person, what do you think was the difference with this person and why they invested?
I'm going to say her name, Susan Kimberlin. I will, as much money as I ever raise in life and as I ever make in life, I will always remember this woman for giving me $50,000 when I had nothing. I didn't even have my own bank account because I didn't know any better. I knew her for a couple of months. I met her out in the Bay Area, and she wanted to do some sort of, she's a white woman worked at PayPal, Salesforce, had started being angel investing. And she wanted to do something impactful, but she didn't know exactly how.
But where did you meet her? Because I think these are the parts of the conversation that never really get talked mm-hmm. about. It's like, mm-hmm. like, where do you run into a Susan Kimberton? You know, like, because I think a lot of folks, it's the same way that people be like, how can I get a man? Like, well, you can't just go to the check cashing spot. Like the nigga you want is not there. Mm. So where do you find a Susan?
So glad I don't have to deal with that. So this particular case, so I was living in right outside of Austin, Texas. I had moved there with my mother. We were staying at an Airbnb. We got kicked out of the Airbnb because we couldn't afford it anymore. So then while I was there, I sign up for this thing at Stanford University for 2 weeks that's going to be an investing course at Stanford.
Okay.
And so I'm like, I got to go there. It costs $18,000. I had $18, if a penny. And I said, okay, well, how am I going to do that? So then they gave scholarships.
Well, eggs, but that's
if you were a woman, they were doing a half off kind of scholarship. So okay. I got that.
Oh, and you
then
did.
I had to, yes, and then
what
I had
you
to
have get, to do like an essay.
You just had to get 3 people to vouch for you. So I just wrote to like 30 people, and I said, can you please? I mean, Austin, and I told my whole story, and I said, this is what I want to do. This I've been working on this.
Were
for
these
three
people
and a half
you
years.
Knew or people you no. researched that support?
No. I didn't. There were people I researched who worked in tech because I had done this before to get my jobs in touring. I had okay. reached out to 100 people, and I did this whole thing that I talk about in the book where I reached out to 100 people, got 20 responses, got 3 in-person meetings, got 1 gig, and just kept going. And that's how I did it. Played the
numbers. Can I tell a quick story?
Please.
In 2014... I woke up on July 5th and I had no idea where my next check was coming from. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait, how are you going to pay rent? And I cried about it for 24 hours. I gave myself a solid 24 hours of tears. So I gave myself 24 hours of tears. And then I sat and just thought about, who do I know? Who do I know that knows people? Like, who are people I've heard of? And I did the same thing. I wrote emails to folks mm-hmm. just asking, like, are you looking for content? Are you looking for content? Are you looking for content? And I got, like, maybe out of 25, I got, like, 2 responses. And mm-hmm. and one of those responses, she kind of kept me on the hook for, like, 3 weeks. And then I finally had to be, like, hey, we've canceled the call a couple times. And is it possible? And she tried to get mad and was like, you're being rude. And I was like, I'm not being rude. I'm really just very earnest about getting the opportunity to talk to you. And I will always say that person's name because it's Shawnee Saxon Parrish. And she ended up being the reason I could move to Los Angeles. Because eventually I got to pitch to her, you know, and I got to, and she did one little episode of a web series, and then, okay, she did like 3 more episodes. And then I finally just came in her office and was like, listen, I need to change my life. And the only way that I'm going to be able to do it is if I get a consistent check. Yeah. And, would you be able to help me with that? And she was like, I'm just going to pick up the, show.
Oh.
I'll pick up the show. And me being able to get like money every week, is what allowed me to be able to build up enough of a nest egg to move a year later. So like, I know a lot of us out here, like you think it takes a bunch of people. It'd be taking one person to change your life.
One person. And Susan, she told me, she gave me $25,000 to invest in somebody else, because that's what I was going to be investing at the mm-hmm. beginning, and $25,000 to invest in myself. And so I set up shop, and I had made $25 stretch days and days and days. So $25,000, please.
You're like, baby, I'm good.
I'm like, man, you know. But I said, if somebody just can get me to zero, if somebody can just get me where I'm not hungry.
Yeah.
You know, then I can do the rest. Give me the rest. I'll go for it. And I've raised millions of dollars since then, but I'll always remember that one.
And so she helped you get there. But like, what do you think? Because she could have also just have been the last person. So
that's
like,
absolutely right. Yeah.
So like, what did you do with that money that allowed you to be able to make your fund more attractive to other folks?
Let me say this. It was the answer to that question, but it was also the 5 years previous, the 3.5 years previous. It was the every single day, every time I got a rejection, I wasn't just sitting there saying, oh, I got rejected. I said, well, let me find another book to read. Let me have another piece of information, because that's what I can control. I can control the information that I have, the knowledge I have, so that I can be ready for that opportunity. So one of the reasons Susan invested in me was because I was able to help her diligence and look at a deal that she was looking at. Mm-hmm. And give her insights into that deal that she did not have herself, because I had spent the last 3.5 years asking for money, yes, but also I call it becoming the asset. If you don't have money, you become money. So I was becoming.
Oh, wait. Say it again. Say it again, Arlen.
I said, if you don't have money, you become money.
You see, y'all, you become the currency.
Yes, the asset. Because money, sir, I, like I said, if anybody's just joining, you know, I don't know why that would happen in a podcast, but if they are 35 years poor and more recently around people with money and having money myself, I know for sure it's not just something I saw on a board. Money attracts money. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have it to begin with, how do you attract it? You become it. So I was ready, because I did not go and party. I did not celebrate. I went and got myself a little grocery store sushi and a cupcake. And I got my butt on a plane to Los Angeles. I went and got a co-working spot where I could have access to a printer and a conference room. I got ready to everybody I had talked to before. I said, I have an office now. This is my address.
Right.
I'm married now. You know, like I was like,
I was married now.
Yeah. I was like, let's go.
Those are the same people that say it's going to rain on your head.
Yeah.
Them motherfuckers now.
And then also in addition to reading and learning, anecdotally, I learned practically, because I kept up with so many founders, so many entrepreneurs who I'm saying, this is who I want to invest in.
Yeah.
So I didn't just leave them and say, well, I'm going to come back when I have money. I kept up with them and kept saying, getting a pulse and a reading. Do you all still need this type of funding? What other resources do you need so that I can be thinking about this holistically? And can I do something for you now that doesn't take money? And staying in that groove with them so that I knew who to invest in. I also had deal flow. They call it deal flow when you have other deals in the pipeline. So I had people saying, I want you to be an investor. Because believe it or not, in Silicon Valley and other spots in the country that do this type of funding, money is like easy for most people there. It's about who do the entrepreneurs want the money from? So you had to become really valuable to them.
And what are the deciding factors that make people determine, okay, I want money from this, but not this person, but not this person?
Yeah, it just depends on who you are as a founder. But what I found, we have 180 companies now, which is a lot of companies for a venture fund. That's just not normal. But we have 180 companies, so about 300 founders. And what they like about us at Backstage is like, we're real with them. We don't, you know, take them on a ride and tell them all the things we're going to do for them and then only do one. We're real. We say we can do this, we can't do that. We hadn't put in the past a lot of money into their individual companies because we didn't have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But I wrote my first $1 million check last year. And so we're
another flex.
It's just true.
Flex number two.
Wow.
I ain't never wrote $1 million check.
You're gonna hate me then, because I raised $5 million on Twitter and Instagram last week.
For what?
For operations for Backstage.
You better raise money on the Twitters.
Yeah. But anyway, and that's a whole nother thing. That's crowdfunding, which I do also suggest to people. There could be, I mean, we know about Kickstarter, of course, we know about that. But there's also equity crowdfunding where you put money in And you may or may not get a perk with it, but you definitely get equity in that company. And some of these can be done with people who are not accredited, which means that you can be anybody who wants to put $100 or more into a company. And it's a whole thing, but I think that's the future.
And that is not the same thing as people who send me Venmo requests to invest in their quote unquote company.
Oh,
just so we're clear, that's not the same thing.
No. And, yeah. The Instagram DMs are just.
I don't even know. Your DMs must look banoodles. My DMs are just full of white people telling me I'm racist. But your DMs.
That's fair. Mine. Mine are, I mean, I have some wonderful ones that are just beautiful. You know, you made me feel like I can start something and you got me out of this rut or whatever. Then I have people who are just like, I want to go to school and I heard you do scholarships. Can you, this is my address and my wire information.
This is my Cash App.
I'm like,
this is my Cash App.
I'm like, but, or people are like, okay. I have the next Facebook and it's also like YouTube and it's also like Twitter and it's Clubhouse too. And it's going to be $1 billion company. And I don't respond to those, but if I do, I'll say, yeah, can you go apply at backstagecapital.com/apply? Cause that's what we have this for, which anybody here can do. And they'll respond, you're missing out. You don't know nothing. And it's just like when you're walking down the street and a guy pulls up and he's like, yeah, come on, ride that. And you say, no, no. And they say, you slut. And you're like,
you dirty bitch. You raggedy bitch.
Yeah, because you said no. It's the same vibe. So I have a lot of that in my DMs.
You know, we called this episode Side Effects of Being Underestimated. And there's so many gems in here that you have dropped about just what it means to come from behind, right? And the ways in which you change or you create momentum to come from behind, right? And I think the biggest thing that I've gotten from this conversation is really just the affirming that it really is in us. And I think a lot of times we can talk ourselves out of that. Like, of course, don't get me wrong. There is systemic racism. There is systemic patriarchy. Like, there's toxic masculinity. All of these things are actual impediments, right? Because for what it's worth, you would have met Susan Kimberlin. You would have had 8 Susan Kimberlins if you were, like, probably just a straight white male.
That's probably true. Yes.
And they might have been, like, just, even if they weren't knocking on your door, they may have been a lot more willing to hear what you had to say. And also, correct me if I'm wrong, they wouldn't have felt like they were doing so much risk taking.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that Susan is a very brave person, but it had to be a risk because of who I was and who I was investing in. And to your point, you're absolutely right. If I were investing in other people or a different person, it wouldn't be seen as a risk.
Would you say that Backstage also helps to position these companies that are quote unquote considered risky? It helps to be the voice to these other money sources because you raise money.
We help them raise money too. So I would say it has a couple of effects. Sometimes it means, like if you're a founder who got investment from Backstage, sometimes people say, oh, okay, they're investing in Black people. That's why you got it. So there's still that we have to rage against every single day. Okay. But most of the time, it's like this badge of honor. It's like this certain school you went to. Because we invest in only 2% of what we see. There are so many talented people out there making these companies. And we invest in a very small amount because that's what you're supposed to do. That's what venture capital is. But the idea of it was, the whole point of Backstage was to be an active case study, to be a living, breathing case study of what is possible. And so we don't want to be the last of anything. And we want it to be something that can be replicated, you know, open source is what they call it. Mm-hmm. And we want it to be replicated, duplicated, flatter us all day and bite from it. You know, that's what we
bite
want.
Bite from us.
That's what I'm saying. And on top of that, what we hope and what I hope personally is that one day we put ourselves out of business because we no longer invest in underrepresented. Hopefully we're just represented and we're no longer needed.
You're not right. Your hook isn't even valuable anymore because it's now just so normal.
Yeah. We're going to become the fat cats pretty one day. And it's going to be, okay, you're not the underdog anymore.
Do you feel like things are shifting? Well, actually, before I ask that, what is a, like, what are the deciding factors for you to take on a company for Backstage?
There are a few. I really do care about the founders because they're the ones who are going to steer the ship for the longest. And so there's a certain X factor there of, like, they call it pattern matching. Usually it's pattern matching for Mark Zuckerberg, but I'm pattern matching for me, which is, like, I call it being hungry, not thirsty. So okay. you're you got that passion, you have that, you're going to that staying power, but you're not out there desperate and just flailing. Yes. Nobody needs that. Also, if what you're working on works, if it does scale and get bigger, what sort of impact does it have on the world? You know, because I, as older I get, I want to back things that have a lot of, like, impact, so I can live through that person, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, I want it to mean something. And so the fifth company that comes to me trying to tell me how they're going to deliver the next cupcake, although I will be eating that cupcake and I will be using Fair. That product, of course. I don't know if it's necessarily like, oh, that's where I want to put, because it's so hard to raise it. You know, on a serious matter, we have raised a small amount compared to most venture funds. And so because that money is hard for us to raise, I want to put it behind something that's impactful. And also, you know, how far have you gone with what you've had? Even if you had few resources, what have you done with what you've had? Because I'm looking at that from my point of view of, you can do a lot broke. You can do a lot with people not believing in you. Do you use it as an excuse or do you use it as fuel? And, you know, that kind of plays out in our portfolio.
I really find it, I just really find all this fascinating because I really feel like the money space, you know, and just entrepreneurship as a whole in America is... It's a dirty game, you know? It's very dirty. It's very, like, muddy. And I know for me as an entrepreneur, I am constantly trying to check myself and make sure that my morals are still in place as I am in pursuit of, you know, capital, right? Mm-hmm. And I ask the question, do you think it's possible to be an ethical capitalist?
Oh, I think it is because I am one. I don't know how pervasive that is. I don't know how many people feel mm-hmm. that way. I think everybody's a hero in their own story. So most people think they are. I could be wrong myself, right?
Andrew Jackson is in hell right now. Yeah, just like, I did what needed to get done. You know?
but so I think it's possible, but I think it's interesting. I mean, the question you're posing is interesting in the way that most of this conversation, I've tried to tell people not to get venture capital. Even though that's my line of business. So maybe I know that it's probably possible, but is it so difficult to achieve that I don't necessarily want to do that, you know, for the rest of my life. I just think, I just would rather see 1,000 millionaires than 1 billionaire. I know that. Yes. I also want to spend every moment catalyzing other people. I know that too. And whatever that title is, in my bio, I don't think matters.
I feel you. Do you think Jeff Bezos and Tape should be paying taxes?
Yes, he should.
Ditto.
I also order from Amazon twice a week. So where, you know, nobody's
pure.
There's nuance.
No, nobody's pure. Arlen, this has just been such a delight and a treat. And there's been a wealth of information that you've given us. But I know that in order for you to get to this point, you have mentioned a couple times that you just research and you read and you read. So, you know, for our segment, The Script, we always like to give our audience, you know, just some supplementary materials, you know, and other ways in which they can continue to support the conversation. So can you give us any books or movies or YouTube videos that you feel like helped you along your path to this space?
Yeah, well, I talk about, people ask me to be their mentor a lot, and I say my mentors didn't know me. You know, it came through books and it came through videos and things like that. So I used to watch a Will Smith video over and over again. He didn't put it out, but it was like a collection of his quotes. I think it's still on YouTube. It's like 10 minutes long, and it's just a collection of his quotes to inspire you. Where he says things like, you know, I'm not going to be the smartest person in the room, but I'm going to be the person that stays on the treadmill the longest. All those things kind of help.
The affirmations.
They kind of help create what this is today. Also, a book by Oprah. I know I'm going real mainstream, but it's truly helped me. All this stuff helped me. So she has a book called What I Know For Sure. Hmm. And what I love about this book is you can read it once a year, and the more you go through, the more it means something, it unfolds for you. And so, you know, she breaks it down, talking about, you know, she became the ATM for her friends and family, and all the, you know, all those things just kind of like just hit you at the right. When I was 34, I was like, of course she should be there. Can I get the PIN number? You know,
right.
On the other side.
I mean, there's a conversation going on right now. I mean, I am not a Jenner Kardashian fan, but there's this conversation going on around Kylie Jenner because she has somebody she knows who's a makeup artist who got in a fight or an accident.
Oh, yes, they had an accident. And
yes, and so she put up their GoFundMe, and she had also donated, and people were like, why are you asking us to donate to this GoFundMe when you could just fund it?
When you could just fund it. Yeah. I mean, we could go on, but Taylor Swift did that. She paid for her backup dancer, who is a Black man. She paid for his niece's surgery and didn't tell anybody. He told somebody about it.
But that's somebody that she works with. I just feel like people will always determine what you should do with your money.
Oh, I see. So you're on the side that she should have done that.
No, I'm on the side that you do what feels right for you. Mm. And that, you know, sometimes that's sketchy. But I think that when it comes to paying for other people's shit, like that's a really.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. It's very specific. Yeah. It's a case by case.
You know, I feel like I try and make sure that I am always paying it forward, right? Mm-hmm. That like mm-hmm. I am using a portion of my money to give to folks who need it, you know, for mm-hmm. a bevy of purposes. I would say education is probably the most, education and travel are probably the most things that I donate to, like young people getting the opportunity to get out of this country and see something bigger than what they want them to see. Something I really try and eventually I'm hoping like by next year, I would like to have a scholarship fund for Smart, mm-hmm. Funny, and Black, mm-hmm. right? I have to figure out how you build that within the guidelines of this IRS, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, things. I can help you there.
Yeah.
I can help you. I have a scholarship with my mother. We did the first scholarship for a Black scholar at Oxford, and then the scholarship at Dillard University. So we do one.
Because I would love to do a scholarship in partnership with the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia, because that's where I went.
Boom. Yeah, you can. I mean, the scholarship part and the nonprofit side can be done. I can help you with that.
Because that nonprofit shit, ooh, Arlen, it'd be scaring me.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot, but nonetheless.
But that's so cool. I love the travel thing.
That's because
that's education in itself. That could be one vertical is education and travel. It's the same.
I was filming the other day, and this woman was walking by, and she was like, Amanda, I just want to thank you because you donated to a student of mine 4 years ago who was trying to go to the Dominican Republic, and we had a whole group of kids, and you donated, and you put it on your Instagram, and everyone donated, and we were able to do the trip, and now three of our students are going to these different schools. And I was like,
yes,
you know. And but I think that when it comes down to it, it's like the ethics of capitalism ends up being more socialism. That's what the most ethical capitalists end up being socialists.
Because you know how twice you made me laugh so hard that I would get the ugly laugh? Because you were saying I was flexing. Because the reason I did that is because it doesn't even register to me that I'm raising millions. What I care about is, I was able to give somebody $1,000. Oh, okay. Donate $1,000. Like, that part is cool.
That's like, good. Right now, we do Smart, Funny, and Black in the Crib. It's a virtual show. And like, we sell tickets, and I'm like, I would love for us to not have to charge for this show. I would love for us to have a sponsor for this show so that we can do this show for free, because the show is all about using comedy to increase community and to empower and to give people a connectivity that they don't have. And mm-hmm. I'm just like, I don't want to charge for this. I wish this could be a free show, like Versus is a free thing on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And but I also know that I have to pay for a staff and I have to mm-hmm. pay for the platform, et cetera, et cetera. And so the other part of this thing too is like, I commend you because you have a skill I don't have. I going to people and being like, hey, can we, that is so difficult for me. Mm-hmm. When I was a poet, let me tell you, when I was a poet, at the end of everybody's set, they'd be like, all right, I have CDs for sale. And they would go around to everybody and with their CDs. And I would be like, I'll be in the back at this table on the left-hand side. And it was like, I know that I could have gotten way more sales yeah. if I had just been willing. But it's like, I don't know if it's an ego thing or it, you know, it's not. It's really a, I don't want to impose. Like, oh. I feel like that's what it'd be feeling like. Like,
I think about it as because I'm the asset, I'm offering you value in exchange for capital.
Well, I've had to really work to get there.
Yeah.
So now I've gotten way better at being like, yo, we got this dope show, or yo, we got this. Like, I've had to, because when you're pitching TV shows, that's what you have to do. You have to go in the room and be like, whether y'all fuck with this or not, like, this is the fly the shit. Ball. You want to get yeah. into this.
Yeah.
It's rapper energy. So Arlen, you have rapper energy. I mean, that's really what it is. You can be, you know, MC Arlen Ham. And like,
did you hear that, Rook? That's my brother. He's a rapper.
Because that's what rapper energy is. Rapper energy.
He's been calling me a bookworm since I was a kid. So I'm gonna put that on loop. That's gonna be his.
Put it on loop, yeah. MC Arlen Ham, because rapper energy is going into every room like, I'm the baddest motherfucker in here. Get on my level.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're underestimated, you have to know, like, they're already underestimating you. So you have to go into that room and be able to know what you know about you unequivocally, and be able to have and be able to do so in a genuine way. And that's what yeah. I think is really the takeaway from all of this, is like, when you said that you had 35 years of knowing where you came from and knowing the value of that,
mm-hmm.
and that was just as equitable as, you know, Susan Kimberton and her money, right? Mm-hmm. And so you were able to, like, really do, that's just a beautiful thing. And I feel very like, I gotta like get it together. I can perform in front of a million people, but it's like telling somebody like, hey, you wanna give us money for this thing? I'd be like,
yeah. Well, I had to keep the lights on too. So I learned how to not only raise capital, but to earn it. And the last 5 years. So I guess it is a skill, but it can be learned by anybody.
It can be learned by anybody. One thing I have had to learn how to do is, as a creative, I do know how to create shit that people want. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I paid my bills for quite some time off of painting hand-painted bags and selling them on MySpace. Mm-hmm. And like, I would wake up in the morning and be like, okay, so we're gonna sell 2 bags today.
Yes.
And then I remember I did a one-woman show, and I didn't get a million on the Twitters, mm-hmm. but I got 8,000 on the Twitters. Mm-hmm. I just camped out on Twitter one night and was like, mm-hmm. you're not gonna get off Twitter until you fund. And let me tell y'all, what Arlen said about money attracts money. So I was on Twitter like, okay, y'all, just give me $1. Just give me $10. Give me $5. And then when people would like donate $1, I would like type in their name, or I would be like, yo, thank you for this dollar. And then the spirit of competition sparks in people. Ooh. And people would be feeling like, fuck that. I got 50. Shit, I'm going to give my 50. And so the next thing I knew, it was like I had set up this energy where people felt like they needed to outdo. Mm-hmm. And I ended up getting 3 $500 donations that night.
Yeah. Yeah.
That never would have happened.
Yeah. I mean, $8,000 off of Twitter is like, I'm never going to sneeze at that. <that's>...
And let me tell you, this was in 2012.
Yeah.
So it was a different time, but But and I've crowdfunded
2 years of my income.
Well, I had an agent who didn't want me to do, she didn't want me to do my second season of my web series because she was like, if you crowdfund, it makes you look bad. And I said, why does it make me look bad? And she was mm-hmm. like, because it's going to make you look like you're begging. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I mean, I am.
How much money did she have?
She didn't give, exactly. She didn't get no money to my web series. I needed $26,000 to do the web series. And she was just like trying to get me to sign with these other web-based, with the, you know, and companies that, you know, just kind of weren't really going to do anything other than, you know, throw some money at it and hopefully, you know, get, it would get seen. But long story short, I was like, no, I'm going to crowdfund because I need this to get made. And I don't want to wait on other people to say yes when I can create the yes.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I'm very fortunate because people gave, and I remember like, I think like Nick Cannon gave like 1500 mm-hmm. and I was able, and he, I was like, can I say that you gave 1500? And once I said that Nick Cannon gave 1500, other people were like, oh, well then I'll get, you know, and next yes. thing I knew I was able to fund it. And we did a second season, and doing that second season, I was able to learn so much about the craft of creating a show and, you know, being a better leader and performing. And, you know, so all of these things, all of these, and nobody saw that second season. Let me just say that, Arla, ain't nobody seen this damn show. Like, I'm about to drop it later this year and it'll be like the first time anyone's seen it because nobody saw it. But the experience of doing it was so valuable, and it created currency for me now mm-hmm. years later because I've done it and I've had to do something from nothing.
The last dose.
Everybody listening, you know, just trust that like everybody's journey is unique. And when we say like run your own race, that's not like a cliche thing. It really is a real thing because you just don't know when your time. Joan Rivers didn't pop off till she was 55. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Arlen, I thank you so much for being so transparent and for really just showing us how to casually flex. You know, that's a skill in itself that I feel like all of us are really appreciative that we got to experience because the casual yeah. flex is an art form. I feel like I need to have you do a course on casual flexing for SFP Society. People, you can get Arlen's book, It's About Time. It is available everywhere books are sold. By the way, when my book came out, people would ask me, where do I get your book? And I was like, where they sell books? So just to be clear, Amazon, I'm sure, sells It's About Time.
Amazon does sell it. You can go to It's About Damn Time. It's about damn time.com. And you can find all kinds of places to get it, including indie places, Black owned places, et cetera.
I personally like to purchase my book from Black owned indie places. So, Uncle Bobby's, which is Mark Lamont Hill's yeah. bookstore yeah. in Philadelphia, you know, that's always a good spot. And the Lit Bar in the Bronx, New York as well. And Mahogany Books in Washington, D.C. All great Black independent booksellers that really do a lot to support Black authors.
And so they all carry you. The book.
And they all carry the book. So Arlen, thank you so much. You are a vessel of information and inspiration, and I can't wait to see what else goes down with Backstage. And you know, again, and I will be contacting you about setting up a scholarship fund because awesome. It's something I really want to do.
Awesome. Yes. Thank you so much for having me on here. I had a lot of fun. Tripped out way too much.
Good. That's good. That means we did it right. We did it right.
Thank you so much for the time.
Oh my goodness! That was fabulous. You see, I be knowing y'all. I be knowing. Like that over S, that was just beyond my expectations. I want to thank Arlen Hamilton for hanging out with us and really just giving us many a word and a lesson in flexing. You know, that it's I think, you know, we always talk about kind of like this idea of like overnight success, particularly I feel like it comes a lot in like Hollywood, but in general, you know, if you are member of any of these groups, if you're a woman, if you're POC, if you're LGBTQIA, a lot of times you really are that, it's going to feel like that because you have to work so hard to get to that turnover point. And Arlen sharing her story with us really was not only inspiring, but it was just so admirable, all of the steps that she was taking, and particularly when she just, it really centered around researching and how valuable that can be. And we have lived in a nation for at least the last 4 years, but it really is an American thing where we just don't value information. We don't value education the way other places do. And she is a prime example of how knowledge is power. A prime example. And so much of this information is free for us to access. And a lot of times I get it. I will tell you, there's so much I don't know just because I haven't made time to go know it. There's so much I don't know because the resources that it's presented in aren't like interesting to me, et cetera, et cetera. And so her kind of just giving us a crash course, really just so appreciative. So check out her book. It's About Damn Time. Arlen Hamilton gave us a word and a flex, baby. So y'all go out there and get your capitalization on in a moral and ethical fashion. And remember that 9 times out of 10, the things that people are using to underestimate you are actually the assets that you can use to propel you forward.
Star Bands Audio, a podcast network.